And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
June. It's a solid month. Not too hot, not too cold. Excited to think it's summer, but not worn out yet from the heat. It's a time of great exuberance. It's like a natural celebration of life. It just is. Birds are nesting, bonds are deepening, summer storms are being born in little whirlwinds of wonder. This is our life, and our year, and our planet, and our universe. And we've got a lot to be happy about. So we get ready to take a journey of the mind as we trace the deepest source of our beginnings with one of the world's leading evolutionary biologists, Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of the greatest moments in life is sitting under a starry, starry night, looking up at the stars, and taking the time to wonder about the stars, and think how far away they are, and maybe to remember that the vast majority of stars you see are from our Milky Way galaxy, our community of stars. And then maybe you think about the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest other galaxy, which actually has 100 billion stars, just like ours. And then, well, you know, this is 2005, and we know a lot about our universe. We really do. And every so often, it's good for you to give your best shot at trying to figure out what this is, this universe, where it is, what it is, because it is. It really is. Today, you have the great good fortune to hear from one of the world's leading evolutionary biologists, someone who has pondered these questions but gone deeper than that. She spent her lifetime reaching deeper and deeper into the mystery of our beginnings and has a wonderful genius at explaining it to people like you and me. She has been featured on PBS, has contributed to the NOVA series, lectures around the world, and has written a variety of books, one of which you will be able to download absolutely free from our website. Dr. Elizabeth Satoris will be joining us following the news. But before we get to the news, I have a proclamation from President Bush that I want to share. Great Outdoors Month 2005, a proclamation by the President of the United States of America. During Great Outdoors Month, we celebrate our nation's natural heritage, reaffirming our commitment to conserve our environment and recognize the many volunteers who help maintain our natural spaces. Americans are blessed by our country's expansive landscapes, diverse wildlife, and beautiful public lands. Outdoor recreation provides an opportunity to enjoy the splendor of our nation's remarkable natural treasures and remind us of our responsibility to be good stewards of the environment. Across our great nation, Americans are taking that responsibility seriously and volunteering to help keep our natural areas beautiful for future generations. I commend these citizens for helping to protect our public lands, and I encourage all Americans to do their part. The Department of the Interior's Take Pride in America website and the USA Freedom Corps website offer examples of ways to participate in environmental stewardship projects. We have an obligation to protect the Earth, and my administration is pursuing responsible initiatives to make our air cleaner, our water purer, and our land better protected. In doing so, we are demonstrating the important principle that environmental protection and economic prosperity are both vital parts of being good stewards in the land we call home. Through these and other efforts, we will continue to build a cleaner, safer, and healthier environment for all Americans. Now, therefore, I, George W. Bush, President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim June 2005 as Great Outdoors Month. I call on all Americans to observe this month with appropriate programs and activities, and to enjoy safe outdoor recreational activities. In witness whereof, I have hereunto set my hand, this first day of June, in the year of our Lord 2005, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 229th. Signed, George W. Bush. So, we are with you, Mr. President, 100% in our desires to protect this earth, our land, our legacy, and enjoy it for our future. So now, the news. We may have gotten a bit closer to understanding the reason why the effects of climate change seem to be coming on so suddenly. It may be due to lies. Well, not directly. But the heat is on the White House to offer explanations as to why their chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality was allowed to rewrite reports over the past 3 years produced in collaboration with leading scientists, which literally changed the significance of the findings in ways which lessened the sense of consensus that climate change was happening and would have serious consequences. Philip A. Cooney was given editorial privileges on final drafts of such documents as the Strategic Plan for the United States Climate Change Science Program, and took the opportunity to rewrite the findings in ways which sidetracked the significance of the findings. Through carefully inserted words, he dramatically changed the conclusions of these governmental reports, which then influenced administrative policy, both nationally and internationally. An example would serve this story well. Listen to the way in which the word extremely changes the nature of this sentence, which did not use that word in its original form. And I quote, "The attribution of the causes of biological and ecological changes to climate change or variability is extremely difficult," unquote. What may be most frustrating to many is that over $1.8 billion was spent each year by the government to scientifically assess the significance such would have on societies, environments, and the future of life on Earth, all to be altered without a scientific basis. Cooney is not being allowed to comment on these charges as, and I quote, "We don't put Phil Cooney on the record. He's not a cleared spokesman." A number of leading congressional leaders are voicing concerns about China's impact on future oil availability and prices. Questions are being asked as to whether China's exploding needs are anticipated to be met by them through development of new sources or through removing oil from the markets through advanced purchase. And China is not willing to play according to the strategic plans promoted by the U.S. regarding Iran, the Sudan, and other rogue nations. China seems very willing to do business with them, thus muddling up U.S. efforts to isolate them economically and thereby influence their options. Sinopec, one of China's state-run oil companies, has even gone so far as to sign deals with Cuba. The future of oil continues to be the gun to the heart of the developed and developing world. On another front, or shall I say roof, China is making big plans for a giant Olympic celebration in Beijing in 2008, and their first order is to literally clean up their act. Dubbed the largest construction project since the Great Wall, China is restructuring Beijing, moving polluted coal factories out of the city, creating massive forests, and most interestingly, planning to turn over 40 million square meters of rooftops in the ancient city into little green acres or rooftop gardens and tree-topped homes, businesses, and even skyscrapers. Led by Wang Xianmin, after considerable research and calculations, the city has determined that planting grasses on rooftops is the most efficient and cost-effective way to clean up the city's air, and it will turn it into a bit of a hanging garden as the city becomes the new international Babylon as athletes and visitors from around the world welcome the grand city back into the world. Scientists seem impressed that dolphin mothers off the western coast of Australia have adopted the practice of teaching their daughters to choose an appropriate sponge, affix it somehow to their nose, and use it as protection against spiny things as they root about along the ocean floor for food. Citing this as a new discovery, scientists state that this is one of only a few demonstrable examples of animals using tools and exhibiting culture, which therefore elevates them one step closer to man. As we will see during today's show, this habit of scientific conservatism has its root in deep, ancient cultural choices. In another area, people who see this have been heard to say, "Cool." And learning from nature to solve scientific challenges, Daimler Chrysler unveiled an experimental car which gets 84 miles per gallon on diesel, due very much to its amazing similarity to a fish. The box fish, to be specific. Turning to nature, Daimler's biologists modeled the car's unusual, yet quite savvy design on the box fish, which sports a unique hexagonal array of bony plates making up its skin, which, when applied to the design of the car's skin, provided 40% more structural strength, yet reduced the weight by one-third. For more on answers to our most perplexing problems derived from nature, stay tuned to a great show coming up following this news brief. And so, to keep things exciting, we say, and that's the news. And a few announcements. Now, I happen to know that there are lots of new listeners. It's exciting to see how the Wild Side News grows each month. If you are a new listener and want to receive our weekly email with each week's show details, you can go to today's show page and click on the Subscribe Me to the Newsletter and send it off, or just type subscribe in the subject line and send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. I look forward to hearing from you. So let's get started with this amazing journey into the history of our universe. Sit back and get ready to wander into a wonder field of thought.
This last weekend, I had the great joy of going to an event and heard a most amazing person. I'm so glad that I had this opportunity. This is Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris, who has a PhD in evolution biology. As a futurist, she's an author and a speaker. Her work has appeared on NOVA. She's written for Horizon and NOVA TV, and she actually did her postgraduate work with the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I'm so envious of that. What a great place to go to school. And so your focus really is on the living systems. And you've studied this in ways that I think have great merit to our planet right now. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to put this in a framework. So if you were to say what it is that you feel that your message is really trying to impart to us.
Well, I would say that my main message is that we can learn from nature how to get ourselves through this critical transition period for our whole planet. And so I've been a student of living systems for decades, quite a few decades by now, and I find that there are things in our biological evolution that have kind of been precursors to what we're going through now in this process of globalization, which I see as more than win-lose economics, which we have to change, but more generally a process of moving us out of a hostile competition phase into a mature, cooperative, global family phase for our whole species.
I'm sure some people might say that sounds a little bit airy-fairy, and yet in reality it's the hard-edged truth of our future. This is hard science, and that's what one of the things that we're going to interestingly address, and that is the role of science in getting us into this position and how science may ultimately get us out of this position. You have traced life on Earth way back to its beginnings, but I'd love to know, from your scientific perspective as an evolution biologist, what it is that you've discovered.
Yes, Sydney. Well, about the airy-fairy thing of relating our social process as humans to biological evolution, let me deal with that first.
Sure.
And just say we are a natural species within a context of other species on what I call this living Earth, and we'll get into that part later about the living Earth. But I think almost anyone who believes in evolution, we are a part of evolution. And we add something new to it with our reflective minds and our social evolution, but essentially the process is a biological evolution process that's not generally acknowledged within the neo-Darwinian framework, and I'd like to talk about why I see things a little bit different from Darwin. But at the moment, you basically, it's that I see Darwin as having been half right, but having missed about half the picture in evolution, and that has to do with the maturation into cooperation. But you asked me to go back to cosmology, so let me do that too. We, of course, have separate sciences of physics and biology in our Western scientific model, and biology has always been a bit of a second-class citizen, since physics has long been identified as the kind of father science, the main science. And so whatever physics says about our universe, biology has to fit itself into that model. And physics has given us a model of a non-living universe that's running down by entropy, meaning it's heading from a Big Bang to heat death in an endlessly expanding universe. Now, quite a few physicists I know are now working on unified field models, and most of those balance entropy with gravity, meaning balance radiation with gravity, I should say, because radiation is the force that's entropic, that obeys this law of entropy. And the unification problem in physics is how to unite gravity and radiation into one single model. So those people who are uniting them, in one case, physicist Nassim Haramein has a model where he calls gravity centropy, so that we have entropy balanced by centropy. Entropy being the radiation force that's infinitely outward, and that of course is what we see through our telescopes, whether they're light telescopes or radio telescopes. It's all electromagnetic radiation. And then gravity is invisible to telescopes, but we know, because we can feel and measure it, that it's a concentrating force, an inward force. So if you think of it as radiation infinitely outward and gravity infinitely inward, then you see that you can have a dynamic balance between these two forces. And gravity can also, as Haramein and Rauscher, his partner is Elizabeth Rauscher in this theory, as they call it, centropy, they're talking about, they're also naming it the generoactive force, because by pulling things together, you permit radiation to expand. The contraction and the expansion are kind of like anabolism and catabolism in physiology. You have one force building things up, the other one breaking them down and recycling them. So it's that kind of a balanced cosmology that gets us out of the socially depressing idea that everything is running down and you have to get what you can while you can, which is what we got from this one-way entropic universe, philosophies such as existentialism, the purposelessness of the universe, the non-living universe running down, has just not been very good for us. Now, if it were true, then we'd have to accept that maybe it's not good for us. But if it turns out that this conception of the universe does not fit the current data as well as alternative conceptions, then we have to rethink it all.
What I want to do is project this into the life systems itself, and the fact that we see this as well in the living systems, the male, the female, life and death, but in particular this coming together of, well, whatever these are. They're not opposites. Male and female are not opposite. They're cooperating two sides of a whole.
Yes, it's a duality that mm-hmm. belongs together.
Mm-hmm. The fact that we do have, for example, male-female is the basis of so much of recreation, perhaps the roots of that go way back into this very primordial dynamic of our universe itself. For myself, my quest has been to really try to understand life from the perspective of the roots of life, which is this cosmological evolution. What I'm trying to get to is the way in which these forces now are manifesting in literally the living systems, to show a continuity, to suggest that the forces of the universe itself and our own existence are intimately related. Mm-hmm. And there, we can literally draw direct logical correlations, potentially, mm-hmm. scientifically, between our existence and life and these manifestations of life, and as well the cosmological principles of expansion and contraction, of radiation and gravity, and that it's real to me. It gives me purpose to realize that what I am experiencing as a human, for example, on the planet, is really a manifestation of the truth of our universe. It's my own concept of a spiritual nature.
Yes, I would say so. And the problem for me with the Western scientific model is that before it ever does any research to prove anything, it has concepts about what kind of a universe we live in. And it started out with this unquestioned assumption that we live in a non-living universe. Now, interestingly, all the other cultures of our world have seen it as a living universe. The concept of a non-living universe goes back perhaps to the ancient Greeks in our European heritage, because there was that model of spheres within spheres, with holes in the spheres through which an external light shone, and that was the stars. So you can trace that idea of a non-living universe back that far. But some people confuse the idea of a non-living and a dead universe, but they're quite different, because something dead was once alive, and non-living means it never was alive, which is the physics conception of our universe. Now, because other sciences in the world, like the Arabic sciences and the Vedic science and indigenous sciences and others, did not have this concept of a non-living universe, I also decided to question it. And I ended up making a 180-degree turn, which I find many of my fellow scientists have made now, from believing that consciousness is a late emergent product of material evolution in a non-living universe, to the concept of consciousness being the very source of the material universe and everything in it. That's the Vedic or Hindu, ancient Hindu view. And they did, you know, thousands of years of research on consciousness and things like that. This was not a conclusion arrived at lightly. And the East, of course, spends as much time investigating mind internally as we in the Western science traditions spend investigating the externals, the things that are our projected universe or our outer reality, if you like. And when you put East and West together, then just as entropy and centropy, you have a balanced view of a science. And I've come to feel that whenever you see a one-way force in nature, something's wrong, look for its partner. Because the original unity of consciousness, that field we can call God or Brahman or whatever in our traditions, that has to create dualities out of its unity in order to make worlds.
Well, that's a few billion years worth of history. When we return, we continue to explore the new scientific paradigm that brings life to the forefront of how we think. When we return with your voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News.